angels who stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the day of judgment of the great day. So both writers are telling us about, first of all, angels which are judged, and they're also kept in chains in gloomy darkness. Peter calls it Tartarus, or what is translated as hell in your Bibles, and you know, Jude just maintains gloomy darkness and chains. So the first part of that question is quite easy. Is it true that there are angels which are, you know, we ask the angels that are in chains of darkness? The answer is yes. And if the Bible writes it, it's definitely true. So the second part of the question, I think, is what Davis is interested in. If yes, why then are we hindered by them? Now, I'm going to assume, for the sake of answering this question, it may not be clear there, but I'm going to assume this. I'm going to assume that Davis is talking about demons being fallen angels, or what we know as fallen angels, or otherwise wouldn't have referred to the angels which are in chains and darkness as tormenting people. Okay? So the assumption is, again, that the fallen angels are demons. Now, like I said, that word Tartarus, which you have in 2 Peter 2:4 to describe hell, according to Bedard, which is the standard dictionary for Greek and Hebrew, says Tartarus is referred to by Greeks as subterranean place lower than Hades, where divine punishment was handed down, and it was regarded in Israelite apocalyptic as well. So what basically this means is, let me say this. So the way we think about hell in popular Christianity is not exactly what the Bible teaches about hell. Right? Many of the translations you have for hell are Hades. And Hades is also used for the place of the dead. Now, let me say this, so the place of the dead, Hades, is a place for all who are dead, righteous or unrighteous. Okay? Now, but if we are talking about Tartarus, they are saying Tartarus is lower, and it is a place which is reserved for judgment or punishment, an apocalyptic place. We're talking about at the end, you know, at the end, apocalyptic. Now, so if we go back to those texts, so again, I'll say that Davis is asking, if the angels are in chains of darkness, why do they hinder us? Now, what Peter and Jude are talking about is actually something which happened in Genesis 6. If you're familiar with Genesis 6, in Genesis 6, story is told that the sons of God looked upon the daughters of men and saw that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves. Okay, that's a euphemism in the Bible to mean that they had sexual relations with women. So what I'm going to tell you disturbs some people because it may not make sense in their heads, but it's absolutely actually biblical. So you had supernatural beings have sexual relations with women, and they gave birth to what the King James will call giants, but the actual word is Nephilim. Okay? So these Nephilims were born in Genesis 6. Okay? Now, think about this. So you have what is called like fallen angels. Okay? The sons of God sinning and having sexual relations with the children of women. So now, if you remember that Jude 1:6 we have read, it says the angels who did not stay within their own position, but they left their proper dwelling. Okay, so They have a proper dwelling, they have a proper designation by God, but they left it, had sexual relations with women, and gave rise to another race, okay, which is the giants or the Nephilim. So this is what happens. Now, evil increased, then the story of Noah comes into the picture. Evil is too much. Noah builds an ark, and a flood comes upon the land. And that flood destroys, the flood destroys the Nephilim. Okay? It destroys the Nephilim. Now, that is where Genesis stops in its description. What Peter and Jude, however, quote here when they are talking about chains of gloomy darkness is not in Genesis, but it is in another book called First Enoch. Okay, now First Enoch is not in what we call the Protestant canon. Now, the Protestant canon are the 66 books we have to get. Okay, now, some people have argued that we cannot take information from Enoch because it's not a part of the 66 books. Well, it's not inspired. I'm not arguing that it is inspired. It's not inspired, yes, but nonetheless, it's still useful. For instance, it is believed in the scholarship world that Jude and Peter here are specifically quoting from First Enoch. And to be even more precise, they are quoting from 1 Enoch chapter 14 verse 5 and 1 Enoch chapter 18 verse 14. So, the account of Enoch gives an expanded version of what happened in Genesis 6. Now, why should I take that seriously? Now, there is what is called the Septuagint. Septuagint is what you would know as the New Testament Bible, the New Testament, sorry, not the New Testament, the Old Testament translated in Greek, right? Now, during the time of Jesus and even earlier than that, you remember the children of Israel had gone into exile, they had come back. Hebrew was a language which is now foreign to them because they've been in exile for a while. But they are under a Greco-Roman world. So Greek becomes the official language. Okay? So the Bible was translated into Greek. And that is the main Bible that was used by the writers of the New Testament and teachers of the New Testament. Simply put, Paul's most used Bible would have been a Septuagint, a Greek translation. Peter, and so it was with Jesus. Now, the Septuagint has these books which didn't make it into our canon. One of those books which is in there is First Enoch. So, Jude and Peter would have read what was in First Enoch. And very obviously, if you read what is in First Enoch, the story is talking about what happened in Genesis 6. So I just say that to give you background of why I'm going to use this information from First Enoch. Now listen to me. So many times, so again, according to the book of First Enoch, the angels that sinned were placed in chains awaiting judgment. Those are the angels that took on wives from men. Okay? Now, the angels, this is where sometimes we make a mistake. The angels, which we call fallen angels sometimes, are different from the giants. They're different from the Nephilim. The Nephilim are their offspring. Okay? Now, so you have the angels, they're placed in chains of darkness. Of course, according to the book of Revelation, you realize that they'll be released at a certain time. Okay? I think scholars believe that's about Revelation 9, but I don't want to get into that. That Revelation 9, I think, speaks about an army which is released from the pit. Now, when the giants died in the flood, their spirits, their disembodied spirits, according to the book of Enoch and other second temple literature, called second temple literature, and what is the origin of what we call demons today. Okay? So those demons, those disembodied spirits, are the ones moving around looking for embodiment. Okay? And those are the ones which possess people and torment them. So this is a nutshell. So it's not the fallen angels or the angels that seem like that which are the ones tormenting. In that sense, if Davis was referring to demons, demons are actually lesser. In fact, demons, if you're looking into the evil supernatural world, demons are the least hierarchy. They are the lowest. So those are the demons. They are spirits of the disembodied Nephilim.
So I will move on to our second question, which is another question also from Brother Davis. And he wants to know what Jesus meant by this statement in Matthew 8:20. The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. What was Jesus' meaning of this statement?
This is probably the simplest question we have for the night. Well, the context of that statement is what is the cost of discipleship. What you have people listening to Jesus here, but he's inviting them and he's challenging them to live a life of those who are going to follow him. Now, if you look at Matthew 8:19, which is in the pretext there, a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I'll follow you wherever you go." Okay, so perhaps in the midst of excitement and everything, this scribe, who is a high person in society, scribe, says that I want to follow you wherever you go. And Jesus, but that statement means that I'll follow you at what cost? In the heat of the excitement of the moment, he makes that statement. Then Jesus tells him, "Hey, don't follow me, but you have to know these foxes are holes, birds are, you know, where they put their head, but the Son of Man does not." In other words, Jesus is going to be in traveling ministry. And when he's in traveling ministry, there's no guarantees. More of the time is going to be at the mercy of wherever they go. You know, who will host them, who allows them, who will feed them. So in other words, it's trying to say, hey, before you think you can follow me, I want you to count the cost. It's going to cost you, you know. There are no guarantees here. So that's basically just it. I mean, Jesus didn't have a home, that's it. I mean, he was moving around, preaching the gospel. And I was just telling this guy that if you want to follow me, you must know that it is not glamorous. Yeah.
Our question three of today is still from Brother Davis, and it reads, why did Jesus listen to the demons and permit them into pigs? These pigs belong to someone, which implied a financial loss. Why didn't he just cast them out? Could it mean something else, or figuratively?
Yeah, Jesus, why didn't you? I mean, why do you send your demons to people's stuff? Well, anyway, now this one, I encourage everyone to take a deep breath. We're going to go somewhere. So, remember my preamble? Yeah, what I told you about the scriptures, context, and what the authors are trying to do something many times, which is away from the surface of what we are looking at. Allow me also say this. You see those 66 books you have together? They are heavily interconnected. Especially the latter part of your Bible, which is the New Testament. The New Testament is heavily, heavily, heavily dependent on the message which is in the Old Testament. The unfortunate thing is that many of us are more familiar with the New Testament than the Old Testament. And many of the concepts we try to understand, we're trying to understand them from the New Testament, whereas they have their seed form in the Old Testament. Now, this is a case, I'm going to speak about something which perhaps many of us would have never thought about, but it is critically important. Now, the man that Jesus cast demons out of was in the area called the Gerasenes, the land of the Gerasenes. Now, the Gerasenes is where Bashan used to be in the Old Testament. Now, if you know anything about Bashan in the Old Testament, Bashan was believed to be ground zero for evil activities. Go back, Numbers, Joshua, look at that area. It was very critical in the context. In fact, another significant thing that happened around Bashan is that which is in Matthew 16, the gates of hell, exactly. So that area is referred to as like the gates of hell. But why? Why is it like that? But I won't go into a lot of the history of Bashan. You can go and study about what Bashan is or Gerasenes, what it represents in biblical times. Now let's zero down on the book of Mark. I want to take this from the book of Mark. This particular instance is in Mark chapter 5. Now, Mark, just like all the other synoptics and many of the other writers of the Bible, he wrote quite very actively about the ministry of Jesus. If you read your New Testament, many of us are familiar with our New Testament, and I hope we are, there's a concept of Jew Gentiles. If you start reading about that from the New Testament, you may never understand what the big deal is about the Jews and the Gentiles. Right? Maybe somebody has asked themselves that question. Now, in Mark, prior to Mark 5, Mark was careful about writing on Jesus' ministry in the Jewish territories, the miracles. Right? Now, the land of the Gerasenes was a Gentile territory. Right? In fact, some scholars believe that one of the signs that it is a Gentile territory is because they are rearing pigs. You know? And the Jewish community, pigs were unclean. So, you are not going to find pig farmers in a Jewish community. So that in itself is also part of a theological messaging to further give evidence that this area is a Gentile area. Now, for those of you who are also very keen, but I'm not going to go into this because it will take us on another trail. This place is a place Jesus came to after dealing with a raging sea. After calming the sea, then you go into the land of the Gerasenes, and then he meets a man with legion. Now, in Mark 1:24, legion asks, "What have you to do with me?" Right? The two instances, right, when Jesus was in Jewish territory and he encountered demons, there's a very subtle difference of how the demons responded there versus here that sometimes can miss our attention. In Mark 1:24, when Jesus confronts a demonized person, a person with unclean spirits, the spirits ask, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth?" Right? What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? However, when he encounters the legion in Bashan or the land of the Gerasenes, legion asks, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God. What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? Now, when we look and we see that there's something unusual about the demon asking, imploring Jesus not to do anything, there's something marked into put, but which appears in Matthew, and I don't want to bring it to your attention. I implore you by God, right? Why have you come to torment us before time? So they ask, why have you come to torment us before time? In other words, Legion is saying, or there's an expectation that there's an appointed time in which the demons would face their judgment. So just keep that at the back of your mind. They're saying, before it is time. What time? Now, this is what is happening. This is something which is actually pointing us back into something which came into play in the Old Testament, in what sometimes is called in theological circles as cosmic geography. So I apologize in advance. I'm going to say some things here in a summary because this may not be the platform because of time to explain that in detail, but it is important for me to answer that question. But let me just summarize to you. So in Genesis 11, okay, Genesis 6, Genesis 7, Genesis 8, you have a flood. Noah survives the flood. Genesis 9, verse 1, God tells him, multiply, replenish the earth. Genesis 10, there's a table of nations. There are about 70 nations. Okay? They're supposed to go into all the earth and they're supposed to multiply. But in Genesis 11, there's a man by the name of Nimrod. He collects this group of people. They say, you know what? Come, let us build a tower and a city for us so that we make a name for ourselves. This will be scattered all over the earth. So they try to build a tower. Long story short, God comes down, confounds their language, and they are scattered. They are scattered. Now, when they are scattered, Deuteronomy 32, verse 8 and 9, can even start from verse 7, goes back to that incident and tells us that what happened is the Lord disinherited those nations, and then he assigned lesser sons of God over them, lesser deities over them that were supposed to rule them. Now, those gods he assigned to be over those nations rebelled. Now, that rebellion, or the received worship from the people, is also spoken about in Psalm 82. Okay? Psalm 82. The sons of God, they became corrupt. They received worship. Even though God had warned both the people and them not to receive or to give worship. Deuteronomy 4 and many other parts of Deuteronomy. So, Psalm 82 is declaration of that judgment. First talks about what they have done, and then the judgment. Then it ends by saying, arise, O Lord, reclaim the nations. So, if you go back to Genesis 11, what then happened? So God disinherited those nations. But then he says, he chose, in fact, let me read this for you, please. Allow me to. Deuteronomy 32. Let's read the 7. I want to read from the NET. Let me read from the ESV. So Deuteronomy 32. Verse 7, remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you. Okay? So this is what happened. Verse 8. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. Okay? But the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is his allotted heritage. So what happened? So if you go back to Genesis 11, God disinherited the nations. Then the very next chapter, Genesis chapter 12, God calls a man called Abram. And in Abram, he says, I'll bless you, I'll make you a blessing, and in you shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. So all the other nations are now going to be blessed through Abraham. So Abraham was an individual, and God was to start a nation through him, and that nation would reconcile all the other nations. Okay? And the other nations were under other gods. So ladies and gentlemen, that is the origin of Gentile nations or other nations having other gods. So you always find that whenever they are going into Gentile places, they have other gods or some other deities they were worshipping. But all of them are Yahweh's people. And Yahweh goes on this plan throughout the whole Bible of reclaiming those people and bringing them back to himself. Okay? So what happens? So when you go to Bashan, now we're going ahead again. Okay? It's the story of the swine there is more than, you know, it's just killing people's swine or goats, okay? Legion comes to Jesus and calls him the son of the Most High God. Again, because they are gods, but this one is Elion. El Elion is the Most High. He's over all of them. And they recognize him. However, they feel that they're rightfully in their place. That's why I have this language of what do you have to do with us? Have you come for us before our appointed time? So there was an understanding, even on those supernatural forces, that the arrival of the Son of God, the Son of God, is going to bring about some kind of judgment to the demons. So they're asking, is it now? Okay? Is it now? According to what we know in God's plan, we still have some time. And in fact, I think the writer of Revelation says, woe unto the earth because they call him the devil is fallen among them and he knows that he has little time. Okay, because he knows he has no legitimate hold anymore because of the work of what Christ has done, what the Son of God has done. So he knows his time is limited. So, yes, that story is much more than a possessed man being delivered. That is true. But you also have some kind of theological messaging about cosmic geography. This stuff is tough for another evil power or evil deity. I'm sorry, I don't know if I've done justice to that journey, but we can work with that for now. But that's something, you know, we have to build on. And I understand very many people are not aware about that kind of worldview. Yeah.
Our last question of today comes from Sister Maker. Sister Maker is seeking clarity on the Bible verses, Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7, which reads, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, can do all things. The other verse is Isaiah chapter 31, verse 1 to 2. Verse 2 specifically reads, yet he is wise and will bring evil and will not call back his words, but will arise against the house of evildoers and against the help of them that work iniquity. So her question from that portion of scripture is, why would God create evil? Yet, in contrast, there are so many other verses which speak of the fact that God hates evil. Also, the two verses speak of God's omnipotence. So, in light of that, why would he create evil? Back to you, sir.
Yeah, God, why would you create evil? So, anyway, this is one of those questions which plague many Christians. And like I said, especially when a calamity hits or something unfortunate, we always revert to where is God? Or... So the question is God the evil? And what do we know? Now, numerous texts in the Bible flatly declare that God is not and could not be the author of evil. I mean, that's something we see clearly in the scriptures. I'll give you an example. Deuteronomy 32:4. Deuteronomy 32:4 declares that his works are perfect and all his ways are just. Wow. He is faithful. God, who does no wrong, upright and just is he. Wow. Okay, so his works are perfect, all his ways are just, he is faithful. God, who does no wrong, upright and just is he. Then Psalm 5:4 also notes, you're not a God who takes pleasure in evil. This is what the psalmist tells us in 5:4, that you're not a God who takes pleasure in evil. If we read the totality of the canon in its setting, we see very clearly that, you know, God is no author of evil. Okay, in fact, God is not associated with evil. If you look at those texts specifically in question, one of the things you may notice is that there is a physical evil in view. Okay? And if we're talking about you, there's a physical good in view. That's one of the first things you may see, and not necessarily a moral evil. I'm going to come to that. Secondly, when it comes to that evil, you will also notice that that evil oftentimes comes through the hand of man, comes through the hand of fellow man. I mean, you're talking about calamity. So if it's not that, you're talking about physical calamities, earthquakes, storms, and so on and so forth. I know many of us, even today in our scientific world, can, you know, give explanations to how some of these things come to pass. However, that is not even the best way, you know, to go about explaining what is happening here in the Hebrew Bible. Because clearly, it shouldn't and cannot be a contradiction of what the authors are talking about. Now, the basic reason is in the language of the Jewish people, which is Hebrew. In Hebrew, well, there's a concept of, you know, about Hebraism or Hebrew, whereby they don't always recognize the secondary action. In other words, permission is oftentimes recorded as causation. And I'll tell you what I mean. What God permits, you'll find that many times is directly attributed to him as something which he does. Okay? What he permits is oftentimes shown, and this is something to do with language, as that which he does. So, permission is considered as causation, even though God may not or is not oftentimes directly causing something. And while we're at this, I'll just throw in other texts as well, which we can take in this whole setting. and we think about together evil spoken of them. Jeremiah 18:11 says, "Now therefore, say to the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, thus says the Lord, behold, I am shaping disaster against you and devising a plan against you. Return everyone from his evil way and amend your ways and deeds." Okay? So God is doing that. So that's what Jeremiah said. Lamentations 3:38. Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that good and bad come? Then Amos 3:6 is another popular one. Amos 3:6. Is a trumpet blown in the city and the people are not afraid? Does disaster come to a city unless the Lord has done it? Does disaster come to a city unless the Lord has done it? So let me first pause and explain again something. Again, I've told you, according to the ancient Hebrew language, permission was often taken as possession. Whatever God allows, he has done. Now I'll tell you this. Right from the beginning of the Bible, this might be something you don't know, and this is why I told you that these things are follow-up of what is presented right from the beginning of the book. Yahweh is introduced in creation as one who creates order out of chaos. The Bible continues to present him as a God who creates and maintains order. Okay? Now, you will notice every time God's order is rejected, every time people abandoned Yahweh, right? When he withdraws that sort of, when he lets go of his power to maintain the order, chaos ensues. This is what the flood was. Now, I want you to compare the flood with creation. But the flood is taught as an anti-creation, right? Genesis 1:2, formless and void, darkness was upon the face of the deep, there's water, there's chaos. Then God creates order out of chaos, land emanates from the water. What happens? In fact, then he builds a firmament, and there are waters above the firmament and waters below the firmament. When people sinned and the sin was so great and it reached God, Genesis 6, and then God is going to punish. What is the punishment? What is the flood? When that flood is going to start coming, it says, the windows of heaven were opened and the depths of the great deep. So in other words, it's like there was a tear in the rakia, or there was a tear in the firmament. Okay, so God is removing his order. What happened? The whole earth was, again, submerged. So in a recreation way, what happens? Land rises, Noah is floating with a boat, and he is also given the Genesis mandate, Genesis 1:26. In Genesis 9:1, go be fruitful, multiply. So it is repeated. So after the flood, you're having a recreation. So God is coming back to set order because there's been chaos. So this kind of pattern is going to happen in the whole Bible. This is what is happening in Egypt with the plagues. Again, Yahweh, in bringing judgment, what does he do? All these signs, when you read in Exodus, God is doing. But actually, he's withdrawing his restraint, his divine order and chaos will ensue. So God is doing it. It will seem as though God is doing evil. But you can say God is allowing evil, or God is withdrawing his restraint. Okay, because men reject him. Now, when it, this is all of this, Amos, Jeremiah, Isaiah, all this is about what happens when Israel rebels, they become apostate, they go after other gods. All these things happen. But what we should happen? You have famine, pestilence, and a foreign army would attack them. That was the template. If you look at it, and every time it's because God was destroyed. And what would always happen in that story? When they went back to the Lord, when they sought him, they came back to their rescue. So it's a pattern. It's a biblical pattern. Okay? So God allows these calamities to come. So the person can ask then, if God allows these things to happen, then doesn't that make him morally evil? Well, you need to ask yourself this question. The question again, which is very clearly answered in the Bible. What is the source of evil? On one hand, look at what is the source of evil. And on the other hand, look at Jesus, who is the revelation of God, what he came to do. Okay, because if you have seen me, I've seen the Father, the sickness of Jesus. The works I do as my Father, I do the works of my Father, okay? So Jesus is the perfect representation of the Father, the express image of his person, Paul will tell us. So, what does he come to do? What was the original issue, the biggest issue? Sin and death, right? Then the Lord reveals himself in Jesus, and he comes to deal with sin and death, okay? But where did sin come from? Sin came from man. Death came from sin. So these are the things which are doing of man. Okay, so this is not evil done by God. This is evil done by man. In the words of the former Augustine, he said, evil is not a substance. It is, as it were, a byproduct of our freedom, especially of our sin. I'll read that again. Evil is not a substance. It is, as it were, a byproduct of our freedom, and especially of our sin. So the effects of sin did not fall solely on humans, okay? But its effects also affected creation. They affected nature. Okay? So these disasters, these things, are actually man-made. God is never, ever the originator, the author of evil. It would be contrary to his own nature and being that is consistently revealed in the picture. If anything, God is a redeemer from evil and a protector from the same.